Resurrection Is Now by Dom Aylward Watkin. Death as the Beginning. We have now looked at death as an end, and have tried to realise the full implications of such words and phrases as the past, no longer, over, never again. Let us now turn to consider what is equally a fact of human experience, that of death as a beginning, death leading to resurrection. Let us now remind ourselves that experience shows that the apparently hopeless is never totally without hope, that what endures is present under apparently entire mutability, that from apparent destruction emerges a new creation, and apparently complete abdication leads to total possession. Natural resurrection. By this phrase we mean that, in the world of nature, all death and decay is the prelude to new life and a fresh existence. If we look at the world around us as we meet it in our ordinary daily experience, we cannot but be struck by the fact that though we are presented with continual mutability, change and decay, nothing entirely perishes. There is a continuity in the natural world. Something that remains underneath complete alterations of appearance and total transformations. We are not here examining this from a philosophical point of view. We are simply looking at it as a fact of experience, for we see it everywhere and in everything. In the inanimate world, nothing perishes and nothing goes entirely to waste. Rocks erode, but the very earth and mud they form become new land, and sand and grit carried from the mountains into the seas form new rock. Fire and frost, wind and rain, all continue their unending struggle to destroy all that we see on earth, yet this destruction is but a prelude to a new creation. Even in the inanimate world, the new comes into being through what we might call the death struggles of the old. As we go up the scale of being and consider that to which the word life may strictly be applied, we see this even more clearly, though in a different way. Plants and trees bud, flower and bear fruit, and after a while die. The plant or tree, as it dies, falls back into a more primitive mode of existence. Its dead roots, rotting stalks, parched flowers and wind-blown leaves are transmuted into a form of existence less developed and complex than themselves. So far, there is a close resemblance between the death of plants and the death of rocks and stones. But with plants and trees we have also a continuance of an altogether higher order. Plants produce seeds, and from seeds come other plants identical with themselves. There is here a new form of continuing life. The plant itself dies, but proceeding directly from it come other plants as living as this once was. As an individual plant it has died. As a species, it has transcended its own death. Yet it is death, apparent destruction, which is the necessary prelude to rebirth. Unless a seed fall into the ground and die, it remains alone, said our Lord. A seed falls into the ground and lies unseen in the darkness and appears to undergo complete dissolution. Yet, hidden in the dark, there is stirring and movement. From the midst of this decay, a new life shows itself and reaches out towards the daylight. As we walk through the January landscape with its bare boughs and its frost-bound soil, there is little or no sign of the great forces of renewal, of rebirth, and of resurrection which are at work. But they are there, and are beginning that growth which will culminate in great trees and splendid flowers. The death of the seed is the birth of its revelation. When we pass across that almost imperceptible barrier which separates plants from insects and animals, we can observe this process even more strikingly. The process by which a caterpillar, itself to all appearances a complete creature in its own right, turns into a butterfly by way of an apparently dead chrysalis is a metamorphosis as striking as it is complete. To observe the stages by which the semi-transparent grub turns into the fly or wasp is to observe a change which is almost uncanny in its gradual but entire transformation. To watch the bird's egg turn into something so different from itself, to see cold stillness and imprisoned silence transfer themselves into life, movement and song, is to witness a change which would have seemed utterly impossible and totally incredible were it not part of daily experience. Insects, reptiles, fish, birds and animals, in each and all of them we can in one way and another see an entire transformation. The death of the old appearances is the prelude to the new. With mammals, it is true, the changes are hidden, for they take place in the bodies of the animals themselves. Nevertheless, they are equally complete and startling. The processes of impregnation, gestation, and birth mark, as elsewhere in nature, a complete transformation by which inertia becomes movement and appearances alter totally. In a million different forms and by a million different ways, fresh life and a new existence come about by changes of appearance so complete that the words death and resurrection may not unreasonably be applied to them. All the time and all around us, these changes are going on. On the earth, under the earth, in the air and in the sea, in almost everything that lives, new life is initiated by union with members of the same species, is brought into existence by the death of its first embryonic presence, and is ordained to continue the species. There is a life force that is stronger than the death of the individual. In man, however, this transmission of life is more than the continuance of the species, for it involves the creation of a person. As we go up the scale of being, individuation becomes more marked. An animal is much more an individual than a flower, while rocks and pebbles forever remain anonymous. But when we come to man, his individuation has, as it were, more than achieved a parity with the species. If we are struck by the sameness of human nature which underlies the differences between individuals, we are struck much more forcibly by the unique individuality of persons. Human personality, since each person is unique and therefore, by definition, inexplicable in terms of anything or anyone else, adds a fresh dimension to the creation of new life. The biological continuation of the human race is remarkable enough, but the birth of a new person is a form of creation that would astound us did not custom make us indifferent to it. We only have to reflect upon the fact that no human being can be a substitute for another, a fact of which love makes us sharply aware with its impelling desire for a unique relationship with a unique person, to realize what this means and to discover that we have here something not met with in the rest of nature, that we are dealing with a uniqueness which goes far beyond mere individuation of bodies or mere differences of appearance and behavior. On the biological level, human births exhibit that total change in the darkness of the womb which man shares with animals. But over and above this, the union of human beings has resulted in a new creation which transcends, while it includes, all that we have seen in the rebirths of the world around us. If we glance back at the mutation of inanimate matter, at the life cycle of plants, insects, fish and animals, we see that the propagation of the human race not only includes all these deaths leading to new life, but adds a fresh creation and newness entirely its own. When we look into the depths of our consciousness, we cannot but be aware that there is a substantial identity in us which reaches far deeper than the continuity observable in the natural world about us. The continuity by which the ash tree in the hedge is the same this year as it was last year, by which the kitten we played with in the past is the same as the old cat sitting on the hearthrug. We have, of course, that continuity, but we are conscious of something more. We have, as no animal or plant has, the power of self-reflection, and we can see in ourselves something more than a mere continuity of identity. When we ponder on our own experience, we find that there is, in the depth of that uniqueness we call our personality, something not merely independent of time and change, but something that can, within limits, use time and change for its own ends, something which is not totally confined by them, something that can wrest universal truths from particular objects of experience, and something that, at all times, is able to transcend not only events, but even the emotions to which events give rise. This shows us that there is in ourselves something that can in some degree transcend the world of change and decay around us, that can arrive at universal truths unconfined by time and place, and can initiate action which is independent in some measure of the constraint of circumstance. We are not here trying to prove philosophically man's immortality after apparent death, but we may perhaps here ask ourselves a few questions. If, as we say, experience shows us something in ourselves that can in a measure reason and will, independently of circumstances, that we are in some ways unconfined by the phenomenal and changing aspects of the world around us, then it is surely not unreasonable to suppose that this something is independent of physical death. If there be something in us that exists beyond the mutation of day-to-day existence, why should it not exist beyond death? Is it absurd to say that man has a natural immortality, that there is in him that which endures beyond the dissolution brought about by material change? We know by God's revelation that this is so, and it does not seem that reason can in any way tell us it is an impossibility. Once accepted, however, this truth gives a totally new character to the whole of human experience. It means that there is something which transcends time, alteration, and death, which will not allow itself to be parcelled out piecemeal as the clock marks the passage of time, as circumstance provides a new change of occupation, and as place presents a fresh theatre of experience. There is that which cannot be confined by our present corporal life or subjected to a capital sentence imposed by purely physical change. It is not that man merely possesses a spiritual and immortal faculty which lies underneath all the phenomenal changes and the natural dissolution he shares with the world around him, as if he were a soul imprisoned in flesh, a spirit clothed by flesh and bone, or a trapped immortality gazing out of a pair of eyes as a man might gaze out of the windows of a dungeon. Man is neither a spirit possessing a body nor a body concealing a spirit. Spirit and body are he, soul and flesh are he. If man has different levels of experience and diverse forms of expression, all such experiences and every such expression are the manifestations of the life of a single organism, of one unique person. Living in time, man is not tied to the hands of a clock. Set in place, man is not pinpointed to a position on a map. Interwoven with the tapestry of circumstance, he is not constrained into a pattern of events. Subject to the scientific laws of the universe, he transcends them by a creative faculty which reaches beyond their scope. At home in the experiential content of here, now, and thus, he possesses other and more spacious dwellings. Knowing the particular, he knows the universal. Ever dying, he is ever renewing life, and having nothing, he possesses all things. Once we see man to be an immortal being and the begetter of other immortal beings, to be both matter and spirit, to be in time and beyond time, we can see also that all we have said of death in its various forms takes on an entirely new significance. It was not that what we said was untrue, far from it, but it was merely part of the truth. It is still true that experience dies at the very moment that we are aware of it, that the world around us is a dying world, that those we love are doomed to death, and that we ourselves are dying. Yet even on the natural level, it is the particular alone that dies. Underneath the erosion of rocks, the fading of flowers, and the death of animals, there is something that cannot die. As we know them, they are slipping from us slowly or quickly, and are ever in the process of mutation. But they have not gone to nothingness, for the very basis of their matter is continually being transformed into things fresh and new. Man's creative activity and achievements show this clearly. The essence of creativity is that what is achieved is something much more than the materials which go to its making. A masterpiece of prose or poetry is immeasurably more than the words of which it is constructed. Music reaches out far beyond the sound waves of which it is composed, painting beyond the pigments of its making. Something has been created that seems to have outstripped the limitations of its fashioning and seems almost independent of them. In a mysterious way, the prison house of the present has been broken open, and we experience something that partakes of the universal, something that has, in a measure, achieved independence of time and place. We find this also in the realm of pure thought. There are moments of intellectual vision when we are sharply aware of a kind of release in ourselves. We feel a sudden integration of experience as we become aware of a universal truth which exists beyond any particular manifestations of it. Intuitions of beauty and love partake of this independence of the merely passing, and in fact the contrast between themselves and the transient nature of their expression is often a source of profound pain. In themselves, however, they manifest, and indeed almost demand, the possibility of a full realization that neither death can destroy nor change mutilate, the possibility that they can be possessed totally and forever. It is for this that lovers long. It is this that poets, artists, and musicians try to express and symbolize, and it is to this that the philosopher reaches out. Again, we experience this in moments of achievement. We have striven and have attained. We have wrested events into a pattern beyond themselves. We have in some measure made the passing endure. Our will has burst through the bonds of circumstance, just as our intellect has seen the universal beyond the particular, and love has known that which lies beyond alteration of mood or fluctuation of response. In short, there is that in us that reaches out to the universal, the enduring, and the absolute. These, thrilling as they sometimes are but intimations only of that natural immortality we all possess. In the very heart of our being we exist above, beyond, and through mortality and change. In the very heart of ourselves we cannot die. The transforming mutation that awaits us is more than that from one passing thing to another. It is one from that which passes to that which forever endures. The death of isolation. We have looked at some aspects of the natural world and of our natural selves in which apparent death leads to a resurrection and fresh life. It will be well, however, to consider another death, which in the order of experience is more immediately a prelude to newness of life. It is not easy to find a general term for it, and if we call it the end of isolation, we are but stressing one aspect of it. Our selfishness, our egotism, our inhibitions, and our ingrained habit of preserving ourselves as something of our very own make us turned in on ourselves. We fence ourselves off from invasion. We acquire an armoury of offensive and defensive weapons against those who would break into our inner citadel, destroy our defences, and take us captive. We cling desperately to what we suppose to be our own individuality, we have a great fear of being taken over. Perhaps the commonest sign of this fear is our tendency to lay down the terms on which we will receive what is outside us. We want God on our own terms, the church on our own terms, truth on our own terms, and other people on our own terms. That we should be totally invaded is something from which we shrink. It is so easy for us perpetually to flee back into ourselves from what seems to threaten to take us over. Shakespeare may tell us to be absolute for life or death, but to be absolute is often the last thing we would wish to be. In no way is this more obvious than where love is concerned. We can be torn between a desire to admit another person totally into ourselves and a fear that this will mean an abdication of ourselves, that we will have left ourselves no refuge into which we may flee. Totally to accept another person into ourselves is a kind of death. It means letting go every form of reassurance, casting aside all our armour, ceasing to count the cost, thinking no longer in terms of what may or may not make us acceptable to another, abandoning hopes inspired by our good qualities and fears springing from our bad. It is indeed a kind of death, for it seems to be an abdication of our identity and appears to make us utterly vulnerable. Our retreat is cut off, our weapons laid aside, our citadel is invaded and our surrender is unconditional. We no longer retain or possess, for we are possessed. This openness to possession is so alien to our habitual selfishness, egotism, caution, desire for reassurance, our measured gradations of giving, our determination to be our own masters, our limited acceptances, that it is a very real death. But it is a death that leads very directly to resurrection. However painful the moment of surrender to another may be, and it is something that in every sense tears the heart out of us, once made, we discover that we have gained infinitely more than we thought we had lost. For the first time we make the discovery of our real selves. It is what we had been waiting for, what we had always wanted, though we may not have known it. We are not made to possess, but to be possessed, and such possession reveals to us what we are. Far from being imprisoned or subject to captivity, for the first time we are free. Free simply because we are as we are. We no longer desire to be valued or judged for our qualities, but simply for ourselves. We have accepted without reserve and we are possessed totally. We cannot fully explain this liberation of our uniqueness in words, for it lies beyond words as who lies beyond what. But it is a veritable passing from death to life. It is not, however, love alone that can thus possess us. Insights of beauty and truth can also make us die to the old and live to the new. At times we can be invaded by beauty, whether of nature or of man's creation, in such a way that it seems almost to tear us to pieces. But it is insights of truth that perhaps illustrate better such dying and such living. Nothing is more easy than to erect barriers to truth in ourselves. We can fear truth. We can have preconceived ideas we will not re-examine. We can have notions of what is meaningful and relevant, and we can find ourselves accepting truth upon those terms only which we have made for ourselves. The moment when truth overwhelms us, when we find we have to accommodate ourselves to it and not it to us, when we become aware that all our terms and conditions, our prejudices and preconceptions have to go if truth is to be received totally and unreservedly, is an agony and a death. But it is also a resurrection, for to be possessed by that which breaks through our isolation, that which sets us free, is to live again, and to live where the narrow has become spacious, the particular, universal, and the passing, eternal. In all the deaths leading to resurrection of which we have spoken, we see that newness of life is preceded by the death of the old, that apparent destruction leads to new creation, and that joy is born of suffering. We have not yet spoken of God, or of his salvation, or of resurrection from sin, or of our ultimate transformation, but we shall find, when we do consider them, that they in no way modify what we have already said. On the contrary, in God and in his salvation, such deaths and such resurrections achieve their full meaning and significance. It is for ultimate resurrection that we were made.